Dan, what got you so interested in the story of the cancer clusters in Toms River, New Jersey?
Well, Steve, I was a reporter for Newsday, which is the newspaper, daily newspaper for Long Island and also New York City at that time. And a very big issue among our readers were cancer patterns or their perception of clusters. And on Long Island especially, the breast cancer movement, as it came to be called, was really getting going in the 1990s. And I found myself writing a lot about it. But I was not happy with what I was giving the readers. I felt like I was not really giving them the context, the scope, to really understand what was happening. And so when I heard about Toms River, a place that was really quite fascinating, where good science was being done, unlike on Long Island, I thought, well, I just sort of filed that away and said, you know, that would be a good book someday. Hmm.
So this is a town along the shore, the Jersey Shore,
and
a number of childhood cancers were popping up.
Right. A town really, you know, its history is fascinating, but I kind of feel like every town has a fascinating history if you dig deep enough. But for a long time, not much happened in Toms River. And then the chemical industry came to town in the early 1950s in the form of a huge factory that was, at the time, one of the largest dye manufacturing facilities in the world. And it was very incongruous for it to be in this very backwater, rural place. And, well, as I explain in the book, sort of a whole series of really outrageously horrendous incidents occurred.
And this factory was actually dumping chemicals right into the local river.
They
right?
were. They were. I mean, the nature of dye manufacturing, especially then, is that you actually generate a lot more liquid waste than actual dye. I mean, think about that. You know, the biggest manufacturing product of Toms River Chemical, as it was called then, was waste by far. They generated a lot more waste than they did anything else. And there was solid waste that would go into sort of open pits all over this property, almost 2 square miles. There was air pollution that would go up the smokestacks. It was it was colored because, you know, when you're making dyes, you're using all kinds of interesting molecules. And they called that visual pollution. So people complained about that. And so the factory solution was, no problem, we'll just burn things at night and then you won't be able to see it. But the biggest pollution problem of all was this liquid waste. And just in tremendous, tremendous volumes that the soil, one of the reasons that SIBA, the Swiss company that controlled Toms River Chemical, picked the site to begin with was that the soil was sandy. It was spongy. So if you've been to the beach, you know, you put water on sand, the water goes away.
Right.
And that was a wonderfully efficient, if horrendous implications for public health, but a wonderfully efficient way to get rid of liquid waste is just to dump it.
So for
it
decades,
disappears.
This factory was just dumping 50s, 60s, 70s. Was this all legal then?
It was mostly legal. There were some things that they did that skirted the law. I should say also that eventually the river smelled so bad and, you know, the volume of pollution in the river was so tremendous that they built a pipeline to the ocean and started dumping in the ocean.
Straight into the ocean.
Straight into the ocean, yeah, yeah. So the context, the legal context is, depending on how you interpreted the laws, it was probably mostly legal. But later, on into the 80s and 90s, it was not. There were a series of legal conflicts with the regulators. Meanwhile, there was a whole other thing happening too, Steve, which is there were a lot of illegal dump sites just by people would take waste down from Newark and Jersey City and places like that and just dump it in the middle of the forest. And that happened in Toms River also, behind an old chicken farm. People would just – there was a guy really disreputable guy who told Union Carbide, "Don't worry, I'll take this waste off your hands." And he just dumped it in the back 2 acres of a chicken farm, and that became a second horrendous Superfund site in addition to the SIBA site. So to finally get around to the health implications, yes, starting in the 1980s, people started to say, "Gee, I think we have a problem here in Toms River." There was a woman named Linda Gillick who started looking around and her son was diagnosed with a neuroblastoma when he was just a few months old.
What are the symptoms of that?
Well, it's a cancer of the central nervous system, it's one of the more common childhood cancers, although still rare. All childhood cancer is somewhat rare. And at the time, Michael's chances of survival were very poor, so much so that the Gillicks, you know, they even bought a casket for Michael, because when the time came, they didn't want to have to buy a casket. But Michael defied the odds. He's still alive today.
How many years later is
this? He's in his mid-30s now.
Wow.
So it's been a long time. And Linda started looking around and making a map. She started to sort of say, gee, it's not just Michael. You know, every time she would go to a hospital in Philadelphia or New York and to get the advanced cancer treatment especially for pediatrics, you would usually go to the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia in Philly, or you would go up to one of the big New York hospitals. Every time she would go, she would meet other people from Toms River. She said, something's going on here.
And it's worth pointing out, I mean, she's not a doctor or a scientist or a health professional. She's
not
a mother.
All.
And
not
she
at
just
all.
Sort of took this upon
she's
herself
a grade school teacher.
To do this.
Yeah, she's a grade school teacher. And I should say, it wasn't just her. Other people were looking around and sort of saying, gee, this doesn't seem right. And one of the most important, one of the most influential people, as it turned out, to notice this was a nurse at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia named Lisa Bornazian. She started, you know, they would have sort of black humor on the pediatrics ward. Oh, another kid from Tom's River. It really seemed like a lot to her. And she would say to the physicians, what's going on here? And the physicians would say, oh, it's nothing. You're just a nurse. Do your job, you know. And it turned out that Lisa had a sister-in-law who worked for the EPA. And Lisa was really concerned about this. I mean, one of the things, Steve, is if you're a nurse, you really get to know the patients in a way that the physicians really don't. You're not just a name on a chart. Lisa used to, you know, she would work the midnight shift and she would spend those long hours with the families and with the parents, you know, who would be, you know, sleeping, you know, in the ward with their kids. And back then, a lot of these kids died. And Lisa would go to the funerals, and she went to a lot of funerals in Toms River. And so she was concerned. She talked to her sister-in-law. Her sister-in-law finally got the ball rolling, and an investigation began in the mid-1990s after many, many years of concern. And I should also say a lot of concern among the people who worked at the chemical plant.
Yeah. Now, the way you've told the story, it would seem like, oh, it's sort of an open and shut case. You know, chemicals being dumped into the water there, massive amounts, and all of these childhood cancers popping up in this town of Toms River, but it's
right.
not so simple. In fact, it's incredibly difficult to prove the cause and effect here.
It is. It's very difficult. And the reason is it was clear that there were way more childhood cancers than expected in Toms River. On the other hand, childhood cancer is still relatively rare. There aren't that many cases. All told, depends on how you measure it, but we think the size of the cluster was around 90. If you want to be more aggressive, you could say mid-100s. It all depends on where you draw your parameters.
As opposed
to what would be
a normal rate?
Again, depending on where and how. For the core area of Toms River, it was a multiple three or four times what's expected. But again, it depends on your parameters. The thing is, though, Steve, that because childhood cancer is relatively rare, there's going to be a lot of natural fluctuation. There are going to be times, you know, nothing in nature is evenly distributed. It's sort of like if you were conducting a poll to see who was going to be president, but you only talked to five or six people. You would get a result. You know, maybe five people would say, I support the Republican, one would support the Democrat. But you don't know whether those numbers are reliable or not. They would have a very large margin of error. And, well, that's true for epidemiology, too.
So how do scientists actually prove that there is a cancer cluster that's
right.
more than just random cases that happen to sort of be in this one area?
Right. Well, I go into that in the book, and it's sort of a whole series of a whole sort of cascade of tests that you that you do, some of them mathematical, some of them observational. One of the most important things that you look for is what's called the dose response. So if you think that you have an environmentally induced cancer cluster, you ought to see a pattern where the higher the exposures were to the environmental insult, the greater the number of cases should be. So you want a kind of a bullseye pattern. Sure enough, they found that in Toms River. And the other thing they did in Toms River that was really quite interesting was they constructed very elaborate computer models of both the air pollution and water pollution to try to figure out which parts of town were highest exposed and which were not. They actually recreated the entire water distribution of the entire town as part of this study. And they assigned every single home in Toms River a value of high exposed, medium exposed, low exposed, and for different years. And then they took those exposures and tried to match them up with the cases. They mapped all the cases. And again, they found very strong associations. Hmm. So now you use the word proof. An epidemiologist would never use the word proof. It's about strength of association. And ultimately, to everyone's shock, they found that there was indeed a statistically significant pattern of associations, although not as strong as some of the families would like, but that's the way science is.
So what was the upshot of all of this? There were lawsuits and a settlement, right?
Yeah, there was never actually a lawsuit per se. I mean, some of your listeners would be familiar with the book and the movie Civil Action, and John Travolta played the attorney, Jan Schlickman, and Jan was involved in this case too. And if you remember the Civil Action story, you know that Jan literally lost his shirt. He lost everything he owned on that case. And
because it's so costly to try to
incredibly
prove a case
costly
like this.
And also he was somewhat reckless in the way that he approached the case. So he wanted to learn from that mistake in Toms River, which occurred a few years later, and he wanted to try to find a negotiated settlement that would be short of the sort of slash-and-burn courtroom warfare that he practiced and lost in Woburn, Massachusetts.
To basically get what you can. I mean, you have to compromise here.
You have to compromise, and that was a hard thing for the families involved. It still is. Some of them are still angry and upset about it. They wound up with financial settlements that, you know, ranged somewhere around $100,000 for the lowest settlements to around $500,000 or $600,000 for the higher settlements. You know, to me, is that adequate compensation for what they went through? I don't think so. But it was what they could achieve. So yes, that happened. The other important thing that happened was that the community activism by Linda Gillick and many others too ultimately vastly reduced the exposure, the environmental exposures. And the plant closed down and moved. The dye manufacturing and plastics manufacturing moved first to Alabama and now to China. So, you know, we've sort of outsourced our environmental problems to some extent. We're happy to get those blue jeans that made in China. And to some extent, we're subsidizing the same kind of environmental practices over there.
Although, so you're saying probably the same kind of dumping is happening now in a place like China.
It's really hard to generalize, right? Every situation is different. There's no doubt that one of the reasons that the big chemical companies, including, you know, BASF and the other major manufacturers that are the successors to the companies which I describe in this book, lower environmental regulatory costs are a factor. So are many other things. Of course, the cost of labor, et cetera.
And are we seeing cancer clusters showing up in China now?
Well, that's a really good question. One of the things that I find heartening is that because of the power of the internet and the ability to share information, even in a totalitarian society like China, there is a lot of tumult, a lot of concern at the grassroots level in China. And people are doing what Linda Gillick did. They're doing their own kind of mapping. In China, the phenomenon is often called cancer villages. The reason for that is not because it's only confined to the rural areas. It's because the Chinese cities are so vast and sprawling that you couldn't identify a cluster even if you tried. But in the village, there's still enough of a kind of a social structure. People actually know their neighbors. And so it is possible to try to map potentially environmentally induced illnesses. So that's happening in China right now. So the process is to some extent repeating itself, which is depressing. At the same time, though, there are definitely some positive things on the horizon, or positive things happening.
What kinds of positive things?
Well, one of them is, as I said, the power of the internet and information sharing makes it possible not to have to sort of reinvent the wheel every time something like this happens. And that's very important. Another is just the general sense of outrage, I think. I think people are not as naive about these things, even in rapidly developing countries like China and India. They're not as naive about these things as we were here in the United States in the 50s.
But the story is even more complicated the way you tell it. I mean, these companies that had settled in, or the big company that had settled in Tom's River, was in some ways a good corporate citizen.
It
brought lots of jobs there. Politicians loved this company, and it wasn't immediately obvious that this was even a problem.
Right. At some level, it was clear pretty quickly that there was a problem. They poisoned their own wells. The company poisoned its own water wells, you know, within a couple of years of opening. You know, the company had originally planned to put a fish pond in its big basin that emptied into the river as a kind of a demonstration of look how wonderful our water is. And, well, that quickly went by the boards because no fish could live there. The conditions were far too poor. So there were some indications, but your point, Steve, is totally right, that people were more trusting and they acknowledged the problems, but they also saw that they were getting a lot of benefits from Tom's River Chemical. It was by far the largest employer in the county. Those were good jobs, high-paying jobs. There were engineering jobs for people who went to college. There were a lot of jobs for people who didn't go to college that paid really well. You could actually buy a house on a blue-collar salary if you worked at Tom's River Chemical. So it was a huge short-term boon to the community, even if the long-term consequences were horrendous, not only in terms of the health impact, but also the environmental impact and also just sort of the long-term economic sustainability, you know.
Yeah, but I would think one of the things that then would be complicated is the political will to go after a chemical company like
right.
this might not be there because, you know, the business interests and the political interests are so intertwined.
Yeah, that's completely true. It took a really long time. One of the things that ultimately undermined Tom's River Chemical and Siba Geigy in the community was its own success. In other words, Tom's River grew rapidly, largely as a result of the chemical industry and also the opening of the New Jersey Turnpike and all these things that brought more people to the town. And then eventually the town got so big that Siba Geigy was no longer a big political player in town anymore, and the pollution was becoming more obvious. And finally, the political leaders did indeed turn against the company, but it took a very long time. Eventually, though, they basically chased the company out of town, but that was 40 years later.
Now, you have a very sobering comment in your book. You say that the chief legacy of this story is to solidify governmental opposition to conducting more investigations like the one in Tom's River. In other words, it was so time-consuming, so draining that maybe government investigators just don't want to do this again. It's just too much work, too difficult.
Yeah, I do say that. I think some people have misunderstood that and said that, well, then what you're really saying, Dan, was that this was all a waste of time and it wasn't worth it. And that is so not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is governmental opposition solidified, that these things are very expensive. They are, as you said, draining, emotionally draining, and they're also very politically damaging for the politicians involved. You get the big companies angry at you. You get the voters angry at you because they want clearer answers than you're able to give them. So for that reason, cluster investigations are unpopular. But my own view is that we need way more epidemiology, not less. And that actually we learned a tremendous amount from what happened in Tom's River. Toms River is a much safer place now as a result of the investigation and the activism that it spawned. And epidemiology is just the study of patterns. And even if it doesn't deliver proof, it's a wonderful way to identify things that we should be concerned about, things that need much more scrutiny. And we need more epidemiology, not less. We need more cluster analysis, not less. And what I was trying to say with that sentence that you read is that government officials feel this way, but they're wrong. They're wrong. They're acting based on their own short-sighted motivations, not what's in the long-term best interests of public health.
Who tends to pay for these investigations? I mean, at what level of government are we talking about?
Well, it depends. It has varied. The main cost of the Toms River case control study was mostly borne by the federal government, by two agencies, the Centers for Disease Control and the Agencies for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, ATSDR, with some support from the state health department too. Nowadays, the federal government doesn't like to do cluster studies. They don't think that they're good bang for the buck, you know. And so when cluster studies are done, it's usually because the local community has kicked up such a fuss that the politicians get involved, and then the state government ultimately does the work, sometimes with the help of the CDC, but generally not. So these are now generally politically driven and funded at the state level.
So are we likely to see more studies like this in other parts of the country?
Yeah, I hope so. There are some that are done, and when they are done, they're usually as a result of a political firestorm, which, by the way, is a really lousy way to decide what you're going to investigate or not, you know, based on this sort of arbitrariness of is there enough local activism? You know, that's not how we should make public health decisions. You know, we should have real public health surveillance where we're very smartly looking for patterns. You know, Steve, we're really good at looking for patterns in other parts of our lives. Our government is getting really good at looking for patterns. I mean, you may be familiar with an arm of the government that has a $80 billion budget and is getting really good at big data mining and facial recognition and all the things that our intelligence agencies do. Well, the EPA has a budget of $8 billion. So it's, you know, and by the way, that's not the black intelligence budget. That's just the intelligence budget that we know is about $80 billion. So we're spending 10 times as much on intelligence, to, you know, in the fight against terrorism than we are on environmental regulation, environmental health. But we also know that, you know, if say 10% of all cancers, environmental factors were important, and I actually think it's higher than that, you know, we're losing hundreds of thousands of people, you know, every year in this country. So we ought to be applying these, you know, these incredibly powerful things that we can do with data that we're using on the intelligence side, we ought to be using on the public health side, but we don't. We seem to think that that's unimportant. Corporations who are involved in this sector will tell us, well, that's not proof. You know, the National Security Agency doesn't wait around for proof. When they see a pattern that concerns them, they act on it. Now, sometimes that's really concerning, but they have done a pretty good job at preventing future terrorism. It's an imperfect analogy. These are two very different things. But the point is that we're still basically operating when the world of environmental regulation is rooted in a bunch of laws that passed in the 70s. That's like a parts per thousand time, and we're in a parts per billion world, parts per trillion world. So there's something just insane about that we're not sort of leveraging the power of data to understand these connections. We do it in a very random, small bore kind of way, and that's just wrong.
It's a remarkable story. Thank you for coming in to talk about it.
Glad to be with you.
Okay, good. Thanks. That was terrific.